This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The Israeli regime strikes various locations in Gaza, including in Rafah City. Russia and China have vetoed a U.S. draft resolution at the U.N. Security Council for failing to genuinely call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. And dozens of people have been killed as gunmen attack a concert hall near Russia's capital, Moscow. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Nearly 6 months into Israel's genocidal war on Gaza, the regime's relentless bombardment and shelling claims more lives in the besieged Palestinian territory. At least 10 Palestinians were killed in Israeli airstrikes on Gaza City. A house was struck in the southern city of Rafah, where 8 people, mostly women and children, lost their lives. 3 more were killed in an airstrike in Khan Yunus, also in the south. The Israeli regime began its war on Gaza on October the 7th. Since then, more than 32,000 people have been killed in the Palestinian territory, most of them women and children. 7,000 people also remain unaccounted for, and almost 74,300 have been injured. Israel has backtracked on a photo collage of the resistance fighters it claims to have captured during a raid on Gaza City's Al-Shifa Hospital. The Israeli military admitted that the collage is published, including pictures of several fighters that have not been captured. The Israeli army says 150 Palestinians have been killed and hundreds more arrested during a raid and siege on the Al-Shifa Hospital, which is now its 5th day. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas had earlier dismissed Israel's claim of arresting resistance commanders during the raid as psychological warfare. Palestinian resistance fighters and medical staff deny that the hospital is used for military purposes or to shelter fighters. Al-Shifa was Gaza's biggest hospital before the Israeli onslaught. It is now one of the few healthcare facilities that is still operating in the Strip, and it houses tens of thousands of displaced civilians. The Security Council has rejected a U.S. draft resolution which linked a ceasefire in Gaza to the release of captives by Hamas. 11 Security Council members backed the resolution. However, permanent members, Russia and China, as well as rotating member Algeria, voted against, while one country also abstained. Hamas welcomed the rejection of the U.S. draft resolution. It said that the resolution would have given Israel cover and legitimacy for what it called the war of extermination against Palestinians. The Palestinian envoy to the U.N. called the resolution one-sided. Riyad Mansour expressed support for another draft resolution put forward by the elected members of the Security Council that is expected to be voted on soon. Russia and Chinese representatives also said that the U.S. resolution is imbalanced and does not clearly call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
Distinguished colleagues, from the very onset, it was clear that the so-called negotiations which our U.S. colleagues have been engaged in on this issue have been focused merely to drag out the time. All of our comments, all of our red lines were time and time disregarded, as were the proposals of a number of other delegations. This was some kind of an empty rhetorical exercise rather than normal work document. The American product is exceedingly politicized, the sole purpose of which is to help to play to the voters, to throw them a bone in the form of some kind of a mention of a ceasefire in Gaza, and to establish the U.S.'s political ambitions in the region through the establishment of terrorist labels, and to ensure the impunity of Israel, whose crimes in the draft are not even assessed. I wish to draw attention to the following. The U.S. draft contains an effective green light for Israel to mount a military operation in Rafah. At the very least, the authors try to make it such that nothing would prevent Western Jerusalem from continuing their brutal cleansing of the south of the Gaza Strip. And what is Washington actually trying to achieve? We have already stated that we will no longer tolerate pointless resolutions which do not contain a call for a ceasefire, which lead us to nowhere. This draft should not pass with the majority of the membership.
Several Israelis have been wounded in a Palestinian retaliatory operation in a settlement near the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. The Palestinian man who carried out the operation was killed by the regime troops. Her correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kendall, has more details.
This morning, a Palestinian man arrived near the illegal settlement of Deliv, West Ramallah, and opened fire at Israeli vehicles. They're wounding three Israelis. This is what the Israeli military had said. Then he succeeded to leave the area, Israeli forces, to the mountains, to the nearby mountains. The Israelis tried to arrest him. They didn't succeed. They sent more soldiers and forces to that area, and exchange of fire continued for over 4 hours. The Israelis then had to use a fighter jet and UAV, according to the Israeli military. And then at the end of the day, after 4 hours and more of exchange of fire, the Israelis succeeded to murder this young Palestinian that later he was identified as Palestinian name is Mujahid Barakat Mansour from the village of Deir Bzia, West Ramallah. He's a father of two, and he was shot and killed. And of course, the Israelis had confiscated his body. Later, the Israeli forces stormed the village of Deir Bzia, and they raided the home of this Palestinian, fighter, and they arrested his wife and his brother, and they caused severe damage inside the home. And at the end of the day, the Israelis left the village of Deir Bzia, but after closing all the roads leading to the village of Deir Bzia, as well as all the roads leading to the villages surrounding the illegal settlement of Deliv.
Iran's foreign minister says the tragedy in Gaza has demonstrated that the world in the issue of human rights, including those pertaining to women and children, is merely a political plaything for the West. In a phone call with the leader of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, said the inhumane nature of the Israeli regime and U.S. support for genocide is also now clear to everyone. The top Iranian diplomat also called for an immediate action by relevant international organizations to stop the genocide in Gaza and provide unrestricted aid to its residents. For his part, Ziad al-Nakala hailed the Iranian support for Palestinian people and the resistance. He described unity among Palestinian resistance groups as key to their success against Israel. The U.S. and the U.K. have conducted new airstrikes on Yemen as tensions remain high in West Asia over the Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip. Yemen's Al-Masira TV said that Washington and London struck several locations across the country, including the suburbs of the capital, Sana'a. The Supreme Political Council of Yemen has condemned the strikes. In a statement, it said the U.S.-led aggression on Yemen violates international law and sovereignty of the Arab country. It added that Yemen will respond in kind to these attacks. Sana'a has also reiterated its support for Palestine as it continues operations against Israel and its allies in the Red Sea. The U.S. and the U.K. launched first airstrikes on Yemen in mid-January for what they called protecting international shipping. Yemen rejects their claim and has retaliated by targeting American and British ships in the Red Sea. And Spain, Ireland, Malta, and Slovenia have announced plans to recognize the state of Palestine as a global solidarity with the Palestinian cause gains momentum. Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez made the announcement following a meeting in Brussels with his counterparts from the other three EU countries. Sanchez said the recognition of Palestinian statehood is the only way for lasting peace in the region. He said the recognition will come into effect in Spain within the current four-year legislative term. The global solidarity movement for Palestine has gained momentum since Israel launched its genocidal war on Gaza. More than 130 countries across the world have already recognized the state of Palestine. And South Africans have held events across the country marking National Human Rights Day, with a particular focus on the plight of Palestinians this year in the Gaza Strip. In Cape Town, people from different backgrounds participated in a pilgrimage depicting the trek Gazans had left to mark as Israel's war machine. It swept through the Strip, and Hassan Syria reports.
Hundreds of people have engaged in a 41-kilometer pilgrimage, symbolically depicting the length of the Gaza Strip and a trek that scores of Palestinians have been forced to make due to the US-backed Israeli campaign of genocide against them. The event has been organized by a collective of Christian bodies. The organizers say it is important to demonstrate that Christian Zionism does not represent them.
The church has been very complicit within this genocide and within Palestinian suppression more generally, and because of that is not condemning what they're doing, is not recognizing what they're doing as ethnic cleansing and genocide, and not speaking out. And we wanted to challenge that narrative and challenge that stance and show an expression of solidarity, show that that's not the only thing coming out of the church.
The demonstration also coincides with South Africa's commemoration of the Sharpeville massacre, when the apartheid regime gunned down 69 protesters in what is recognized as a turning point in the struggle for liberation. For those who participated, the Palestinian suffering resonates deeply.
And what I saw today in my own, as I walked, you know, because it's a pilgrimage, reflecting, I said to myself, I feel my feet, you know, burning. I feel this old legs not moving as it should. But it's nothing in comparison what people are experiencing.
The South African public is still asleep, and they must start waking up to see what Israel is doing. But what they do there, they can also come and do anywhere else in the world.
I'm a proud Jew. I'm not a Zionist, and I never have been. And I think that what the Netanyahu government is doing is actually a moral genocide. Whether they call it a legal, I don't know whether it fits legally, but it's morally a genocide. And I'm appalled. I'm heartbroken. As somebody who's lived through apartheid, we have seen this before. We should know better.
The Gaza ceasefire pilgrimage coincided with the somber Christian period of Lent, and sacrifice and resilience were recurring themes pilgrims pointed to as they attempted to symbolically walk in the footsteps of Gazans. The Gaza ceasefire march is another example of the human resolve for justice. And as Palestinians endure the latest Israeli aggression for almost 6 months now, the people of the world will only intensify their commitment for Palestinian liberation. Hassan Siriep, Cape Town.
The worst terror attack in Russia in years. At least 60 people have been killed and 145 wounded in a shooting attack claimed by Daesh terrorist group. The death toll could still rise as dozens of the injured are in serious condition. The attack happened when gunmen in combat figures opened fire and detonated explosives in the major concert hall on the outskirts of Moscow. In a Telegram post, the Daesh terrorist group said gunmen had managed to escape afterwards. Russia's authorities have launched a massive manhunt. The Moscow mayor says that all cultural, sporting, and other mass events would be cancelled in the capital for the weekend. The attack is the worst in Russia since 2004 in Beslan School siege, which is more than 330 people, half of them children, were killed. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Hunger is particularly acute in the bombed-out northern half of Gaza, including Gaza City, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians remain after the Zionist regime ordered the forced displacement of people from the area a month earlier. Palestinians in the north of Gaza are now starving, as the Zionist regime has prevented the UN from delivering aid there for more than a month. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza said that 112 Palestinians were killed and another 760 injured after the Zionist regime forces opened fire toward Palestinians who had gathered to receive food aid in Gaza City recently. The incident, dubbed the Flour Bag Massacre, is one of the deadliest in the past bloody 4.5 months in Gaza, with the death toll climbing past 30,000 recently. The actual number of fatalities since October 7th is luckily significantly higher, with thousands of people missing under the rubble of destroyed buildings and others succumbing to disease, starvation and thirst. An engineered famine has taken hold in Gaza, with people resorting to eating wild plants with little nutritional value and animal feed to survive. Abu Bakr Abed, speaking from Gaza, told the Electronic Intifada live stream, "It's been all suffering. It's been all horror." Hundreds of babies are born in Gaza each day, and their parents can't find formula or afford diapers for their newborns, as Abed reported in a recent story for the Electronic Intifada. Abed, who is immunocompromised, said that he has eaten meat probably only once since October 7th, and the lack of access to the nutrition he needs has caused him to be repeatedly sick. The lack of clean water results in regular stomach pain. With a meal typically consisting of just a piece of bread and tomato, Abed said that he's relatively fortunate. One in four people in Gaza currently faces catastrophic levels of food insecurity, according to the United Nations. Hunger is particularly acute in the bombed-out northern half of Gaza, including Gaza City, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians remained after the Zionist regime ordered the forced displacement of people from the areas months earlier. Palestinians in the north of Gaza are now starving, as Israel has prevented the UN from delivering aid there for more than a month. Seven children have died from starvation and dehydration at Kamal Adwan Hospital in the north, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza. Life essentials and humanitarian aid are being used as weapons of war in the Zionist regime's military campaign in Gaza, with Israel announcing on October 9th that it had cut off the supply of fuel, electricity, water and food to the territory. Only very limited amounts of aid have been allowed into Gaza since then, for less than what is needed to meet the needs of the now mostly displaced population. In late January, the International Court of Justice ruled that there is a plausible risk of genocide in Gaza, echoing Palestinian human rights groups and several independent UN human rights experts. The court ordered the Zionist regime to halt all genocidal acts, including by taking immediate and effective measures to enable the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance. The food aid massacre in Gaza City is a flagrant violation of international humanitarian law and fully goes against the International Court of Justice provisional measures ordering the Zionist regime to halt genocidal actions, Petra D. Sutter, a deputy prime minister in Belgium, said recently. The Geneva-based Euromed Human Rights Monitor said that at around 4:30 a.m. recently, Israeli regime tanks shelled a crowd of thousands of hungry civilians who had been waiting hours for aid trucks to arrive. The rights group has documented previous cases in which Israeli regime troops opened fire toward and killed people awaiting aid. Recently, according to Euromed Monitor, after the aid trucks arrived, Palestinian civilians were targeted by Israeli regime shelling and shooting. Numerous people fell from the trucks, while attempting to take a bag of flour, the group said, adding many others were targeted while carrying a carton of canned goods or a bag of flour to feed their starving family members. Ismail Al-Ghul, a reporter with Al Jazeera, said that after opening fire on them, Israeli regime tanks ran over dead and injured people and that ambulances were unable to reach the scene because the roads are totally destroyed. Many of the injured were brought to the Ashifa hospital, which is only partly functional after being raided by Israeli regime forces last November. With a shortage of medical staff, citizens were left to deal with the injured and attempt to administer first aid themselves, according to Euromed Monitor. Jadallah Al-Shafai, a department head of Ashifa Hospital, said that the majority of the victims suffered gunshots and shrapnel in the head and upper parts of their bodies. Al-Shafai added that they were hit by direct artillery shelling, drone missiles, and gun firing. Videos documenting the incident show people running as shots ring out with an Israeli tank positioned nearby. At least one victim appears to have been shot in his upper torso. Daniel Hagari, the chief Israeli regime military spokesperson, said during a press conference recently that the trucks were part of a convoy carrying aid from Egypt that was screened at the Karam Abu Salem crossing and then entered Gaza for distribution by private contractors. He claimed that tanks were present to secure the humanitarian corridor for the aid convoy and that troops cautiously tried to disperse people he described as a mob who rushed the truck with a few warning shots. Hagari attempted to deflect responsibility by saying that the tank commander decided to retreat to avoid harm to the thousands of Gazans that were there and claimed no Israeli military strike was conducted toward the aid convoy. He claimed that similar aid operations took place the previous 4 nights without incident. The massacre was applauded by the Zionist regime's public security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, and celebrated on popular Hebrew language telegram channels. A majority of Jewish Zionists opposed the transfer of humanitarian aid to Gaza. In a statement published on its telegram channel, the resistance movement Hamas rejected the Israeli regime's spokesperson's claims as baseless lies intended to cover up this heinous crime and to evade widespread international condemnation. Ashraf Al-Ghadra, spokesperson for the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza, accused the child killer regime of Israel of carrying out a premeditated massacre. It is not clear who sent the aid trucks, with some people saying that it was a trap. The Euromed Human Rights Monitor said that Palestinians in the area received phone calls from the Israeli army in recent days ordering them to evacuate to the central and southern parts of the strip in order to receive food and water and avoid starvation. Yosri Al-Ghul, a Palestinian novelist and eyewitness to the massacre, told Al Jazeera that there were no international or any local institutions that said that they sent aid to Gaza City. He said that every day people gather in the area near the Israeli regime tanks in anticipation of aid deliveries. Al-Ghul said, "We are starving. We don't find food, even the food of animals, for about 2 months. Our children are starving. While children die from lack of food, their parents are killed trying to get it for them." Jason Lee, Save the Children's Palestine director, said, adding, We need a definitive ceasefire immediately, echoing the long-standing call from humanitarian actors operating in Gaza.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint,
a critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio, whereby we try to criticize movies with religious, spiritual, and metaphysical themes. Well, one of those movies that we decided to talk about and criticize is Celestine Prophecy, which was directed by Armand Mastroianni, produced in 2006. Well, IMDb actually gives it 4.8 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes, 4%, I don't know why, and the box office for that movie was $1.5 million. Well, some of the major, actors and actresses are Matthew Sell, Sarah Wayne Callies, Hector Elizondo, and Annabeth Gish, to just name a few. Well, the whole story is about John Woodson. This guy is a high school teacher who loses his job, or laid off, and decides to visit Peru. His trip takes a turn after he makes up his mind to look for a manuscript that leads him to a new awakening. Well, before we start our session or this episode, let me greet my guest speakers. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid Abdullah, and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And brother Yasser, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the studio again.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Always a pleasure to be with you, brother Muhammad Jawad.
Thank you very much. The pleasure is all mine. Well, let's take a listen to a short part of this movie, Celestine Prophecy, and then we'll be back with his criticism. Don't go away.
Put your fingers together like this. Go ahead. You're going to look at the space between your fingers.
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. This is Muhammad Jawad hosting this program, and we are trying to start the criticism of the movie Celestine Prophecy, produced in 2006, and directed by Armand Mastroianni. Well, Sayyid Abdullah, let me start with you. In this episode, what are the 9 insights and what do they represent? Would you talk about these insights which are this movie is trying to portray in this movie?
Well, in this movie, when they talk about the 9 insights, to be precisely frank, the whole movie was so boring in its nature that
yes.
I really could not focus on what they're trying to get at. So what the whole idea was is that they get you to move through, like what I compared to this, what the, is it the Hindus or the Buddhists, they call it chakras.
Yes, chakras,
so you unlock a chakra and then you can relieve yourself from one of the limitations of the body itself until you reach a complete, like just a spirit where you can extract your soul from the body. So I'm not aware of the first eight, but the last one is where you actually project yourself outside. So there wasn't much emphasis in the movie about the eight stages. They would just mention them, and they would just focusing on the 10th one or the 9th one, where they want to, the 9th insight that you go through, which to me made no sense, to be quite honest. I didn't get anything out of this.
I see.
So maybe Brother Ibrahim can shed a light on that.
I see. Of course, you said it was quite boring, but I found this movie adventurous, kind of.
How,
you know?
So? Which part of it was adventurous?
Like, you couldn't, like, for example, expect what's next, or at least you couldn't predict what's going on, like, in the next scene.
It was very predictable, actually. It was very predictable in its nature because you could see where it's going from the beginning. So there were the good guys, the bad guys.
I'm not talking about the message it was trying to portray. I mean, like the nine insights. And you didn't know what the insights held.
No, technically speaking, when we want to talk about the insights, so you begin with synchronization, right? So you synchronize the human body. You try to visualize the history, which is something that he was constantly having himself. He was having visions of the past. And then they have the talk about energy, which you can construct your energy, understanding your energy, conflicting with your energy, clearing your past, the energy flow, the personal ethics. And I think these are the things that they were trying to get at. Because, mind you, this is all based on the book itself.
Yeah.
It was based on a book. But they didn't do it very well. Didn't do a really good job in trying to put these nine into practice, where first he synchronized himself with whatever is around him, and then he moves into history, and then he challenges his energy, and then the rest. So this is why I said I couldn't figure out what exactly he was trying to do. But at the end, when they trying to tell him, okay, now you've reached the energy stage where you can see things in a different perspective, now you can sync with other people, you can transfer energy, and then at the end is the insight, which even on that, there wasn't much focus. So the movie itself was as afloat as the book itself.
I see. Thank you very much. Well, let's take a short break by listening to a part of the movie, Celestine Prophecy, produced in 2006, directed by Armand Mastroianni. And then we'll be back and continue our program, Viewpoint, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
I met Jose in Boston at an anthropological meeting. We kept in touch over the years, but I had no idea what he had found until several weeks ago. He called me, asked me to help affirm the prophecy's authenticity. He sent me copies of the first two scrolls along with translations. Real thing. There's no doubt about it. Written no later than 5 or 6 BC, but you know the curious thing. They were found in a wooden box, which dates to only about 1600 AD. Someone in the early church had buried them.
Early church? Franciscan or Jesuit? Oh, I'm a history teacher.
Well, apparently Franciscan, although they seem to be inspired by a pope, Celestine V, I think.
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mama Jawad, hosting this program, and Syed Abdullah and Brother Yasser, my guest speakers, trying to help me criticize the movie Celestine Prophecy, produced in 2006, directed by Armand Mastroianni. Well, Brother Yasser, in addition to the insights, well, in the movie, of course, it shows that there are nine insights, but at the end, like after capturing, you find out there is going to be more insights, though. In addition to the insights, there are also nine keys, which are talked about in the movies. What's the role of the nine keys?
I think that, obviously, there were nine scrolls. So maybe the number nine has some significance here. So in ancient Greek philosophy, especially in Pythagorean philosophy, which was based on numbers, number nine was like
holy.
The number that had, because after nine was the last number. And then there was that the numbers would become tarkib, they would be joined together, 1 and 0, 1 and 1.
Yes.
So 9 was like the maximum number, was the highest number. It had the highest sort of flow through it, and so on and so forth.
Yes.
So 9 has had some significance to it. I mean, in Islam, we have this ilm of Jafar, or the ilm of numerology as well.
Yeah,
true. So again, there may be why the number 9 is significant here, but as the story goes on, there's the 10 insights, and as we read the books, there are 12 insights, and God knows what else will come up afterwards. But again, I'm assuming from the movie itself that one of the keys opens one of the insights. I'm assuming that's what it was. One key opens inside one, key two opens inside. But again, what do you mean by key? Then it's not a physical key. Yeah. It is a realization by the person himself. So when he realizes something, one insight comes. Or when the person realizes the second thing, the second insight comes. When he realizes the third thing, and so on and so forth. And this is what I'm assuming this was around anyway.
Yes, exactly.
But again, I don't know. I haven't read the book. But I don't know, again, just to put it out there, whether or not the actual insights are based on Christianity or not. Like, is there a link between the two, between the actual Christian faith and these insights? Or did the movie just kind of amalgamate it within Christianity? Something needs to be seen or checked.
Solely it's based on Buddhism, but a little bit, you know, it's touched by the New Age spirituality, which comes out of Christianity too.
Yeah, so again, so it's not actual Christianity then. Yes, so it's not because Catholicism... Not.
That's
it's not like
the mystical aspect of Christianity.
Yeah. I mean, does it come out from like the Catholic side of it or from the Protestant side of it, it's also important to see.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue the program, Viewpoint, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
Dream anything last night? Yeah. Little girl I dreamed about before.
Makes no sense.
It's probably important.
Why would you say that?
Because regardless of how confusing they are, dreams are always trying to tell us something. Maybe you just need a larger perspective.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speakers, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser, helping me criticize the movie Celestine Prophecy, produced in 2006, directed by Armand Mastroianni. Well, Sayyid Abdullah, what's the significance of Inca ruins in the movie? You know, Brother Yasser, you know, in the last section of this episode, talked about numerology, which is also, you know, somehow a kind of esoteric kind of science, you know, which is taught and studied, in fact, in certain selected places or, you know, centers, well, in different religions or even spiritual cults or occult practices, you know, we also have synchronicity, which is a major theme in one of Carl Jung's philosophy, or rather psychology, I should say. Mm. You know, these are very important concepts when it comes to such, you know, discussions. You know, we shouldn't avoid talking about Carl Jung, who was, you know, a major legendary figure in this regard, or a champion, sort of, you know. Even he wrote a book about synchronicity. But in addition to that, what is the significance of the Inca ruins in the movie?
So when it comes to ruins and when it comes to historical sites, especially the ancient ones, people of that time, and even now, sometimes they hold significant to these people from religious or not only religious, but even, what's the word I'm after?
Ritual.
Ritual, thank you. From ritual perspectives where they connect to.
Yes.
And this is, I don't think it's limited to a certain culture, but even us as Muslims, we do have such things, we have such attachments to these ruins. Now, the further you go back in history, for example, whether it is in Peru, in Brazil, like in North America in general, you'll find most of these sites that at some certain point held significant position or status to the people of that time, and it continued through this time. So back in the day, I'm not sure if
if in these ruins in Peru in particular, since it's an Amazonic kind of forest or place, where a lot of really, like if you read in history, you see a lot of really horrible rituals were taking place.
Mm.
And I now, for some reason, the movie Apocalypse came into my mind.
Yes.
With Mel Gibson, where they used to sacrifice people for the sake of God. So it held significance back in the day. So now with the movie, I think Brother Ibrahim was saying that you said it's a Christian in its nature. Actually, it's the opposite. They're trying to say, no, we have something that even Christianity cannot give us anymore.
Mm.
We want something, a prophecy that came from a land so far that they had an insight of the future. So they're trying to give it that value mm-hmm. that was such a place.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason then, in the same place as they go into visions, these people were Christians. So I think I asked you before the show if this ruins before Christ or even after Christ, but since it's way before Christ,
yes,
I don't know why they're bringing Christianity in between and the scrolls being written by the Christians themselves or even the guy here, the priest, yes. who found them.
Yes, exactly.
So it's, like I said, so the whole movie, the whole book, it wasn't making sense to me as much as I hoped it mm-hmm. would.
Thank you very much, Sayyid Abdullah. And thank you very much, Brother Yasser, for your nice contribution to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio, in which we try to criticize the movie Celestine Prophecy, produced in 2006, directed by Armand Mastroianni. Of course, we haven't finished its criticism, and hopefully we'll do that in the upcoming episode. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Relax your focus just a bit. What do you see?
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish. Ayahs, 30 days. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. A monotheist person not only reflects on the Quran, but also tries to explain the ayahs of this heavenly scripture to others and make them familiar with its teachings. Explicating of the Quranic teachings, first of all,
was the duty of the Prophet and his infallible successors, every faithful too, according to the extent that they had learned from the Ahlul Bayt, embarked on this heavy duty. So the ulema, that are Muslim scholars, took over this duty after the occultation of the 12th infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, and have seriously continued this job till the present day. Today, this duty has become highly important due to the broad assault of enemies against the beliefs of Islam and humanity. The topic of the 11th episode of our Ramadan special series is self-sacrifice and martyrdom seeking, with a focus on Ayah 111 of Surah Tawbah of the Noble Quran. Stay tuned, please. We have all heard that the Messenger of Mercy, Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said in part of his sermon on the verge of arrival of the blessed month of Ramadan that the gates of hell are closed and the gates of paradise are open. He also said that Satan and his troops are tied in chains in this month. So, it is the best time for getting close to God through doing righteous deeds. Ramadan is the best period to achieve the best degrees in servitude of Allah. In part of Ayah 111 of Surah Tawbah, we read, "Indeed Allah has bought from the faithful their souls and their possessions for paradise to be theirs." In every dealing, there are five pillars. God says that He is the buyer and the faithful are the sellers. Their souls and properties are the merchandise, and paradise is the price of the dealing. These were the four pillars of this dealing. Then Allah continues, "They fight in the way of Allah, kill and are killed." Then Allah mentions the fifth pillar, which is the valid document for the dealing. He says, "A promise binding upon him in the Torah and the Evangel and the Quran." Then Allah stresses, "And who is truer to his promise than Allah?" In the end, he congratulates the sellers, saying, "So rejoice in the bargain you have made with him, and that is the great success." Whenever something is said briefly in the Quran, it is explained in the following ayahs. Here too, Allah mentions nine characteristics of the faithful who sell their souls to Allah are penitent, devout, celebrators of Allah's praise, who fast, who bow in prayer, prostrate in prayer, bid what is right, and forbid what is wrong, and keep Allah's bounds. Then Allah tells the Prophet, "And give good news to the faithful." When the faithless of Quraysh decided to kill the Prophet at night in his house, Imam Ali, peace upon him, slept instead of him in his bed so that the Prophet could leave the city secretly. God told his two great angels, Gabriel and Michael, "I have made you brothers and ordained the life of one longer than the other. Which of you is ready to have a shorter life?" Both of them asked for longer life. God then said, "I have made Ali ibn Abi Talib and the Prophet as brothers of one another. Now Ali has slept in the bed of his cousin, Muhammad Mustafa, instead of him, to be killed and preserve his life. Now go to the earth and guard him. Then Gabriel stood over Imam Ali's head and Michael stood below his feet. Gabriel extolled Imam Ali with the words, "Allah is boastful of you," to the angels. At that point, Ayah 207 of Surah Baqarah was revealed about this unmatched virtue of Imam Ali, which reads, "And among the people is he who sells his soul seeking the pleasure of Allah, and Allah is kind to servants." One of the best gifts of Allah to the faithful is martyrdom. Why is it a gift? Because everyone will die and there is no escape from it. Our most serious concern is related to after death, as we don't know what will happen to us. But martyrdom, which means being killed in the way of God, turns this unclear and worrying future to an honorable happening in both this world and the hereafter. The soul is the thing that men will lose inevitably, but Allah sells it with martyrdom and pays paradise as the price. This is not exclusive for Muslims. Allah has promised this in the Torah and the Evangel too. Moreover, it should be noted that martyrdom is among the concepts which few will be qualified enough to attain it. The most important factor to attain martyrdom is self-sacrifice, and the highest self-sacrifice is to sacrifice one's soul as the most precious property. Martyr is a person who sacrifices his soul consciously and insightfully in the way of Allah. It means that he or she prefer Allah's satisfaction to theirs. They abandon their soul, their children, their properties, their positions, and all beauties and pleasures of the world. In Iran, too, martyrs lost their souls. They were the martyrs before the Islamic Revolution, the martyrs of the eight-year imposed war, martyrs who defended the holy shrines in Iraq and Syria, and those who were martyred for security of people in cities and borders. They lost their souls, but not their religion. Their only goal was to obey Allah and revive his religion. Martyr Mehdi Zainuddin, the renowned Iranian commander of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib division during the Holy Defense against Saddam's Ba'athist army, said on the self-sacrifice of the combatants, "In one of the operations we faced with barbed wire and couldn't open the passage. We had to cross from there. The group commander gathered the forces and consulted with them. Everyone said something, but the best suggestion was that one of two persons lie of the barbed wire so that others could pass over them. Everyone volunteered and wanted to open the way for the group. At last, lay on the barbed wire with their faces. When they were asked as why they lay that way, they answered, they didn't want to make others feel shy when seeing their faces."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice.
This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio,